Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning or afternoon, depending on where you are. I had a show that I ran yesterday, and definitely wanted to do another one today with one of my co-hosts who's going to be calling here in a few minutes. I feel like this is an important show to have. Oh, by the way, you're listening to Mental Illness Matters. My name is Chrissy Hodges. I am your host, and I've been doing this show for a couple years now. Have guests on that tell their personal stories about supporting someone with a mental illness or how they live successfully with a mental illness. And we kind of moved into this format where I have co-hosts come on who have also experienced mental illness themselves or been a direct supporter of someone with mental illness, and we're just talking about different topics that kind of go around stigma. I'm just trying to break down the stigma of mental illness and addiction. Now, this topic in general is we're going to focus today on addiction. Now, I typically have Margaret Sisson on when we talk about addiction. She was a supporter for her son, Riley, who struggled with addiction obsessive compulsive disorder. So she has that firsthand experience of what it's like to be right there in a support system, and it can be so tough. And the reason why I wanted to talk about this topic today is I was meeting with some friends a few weeks ago, and they were talking about a family member that was struggling and with addiction, and they were talking about some of the behaviors that go along with being an addict. And I mean, I think that general knowledge of addiction is really, really skewed. And then when you are when you're a supporter of, or if you are an addict, you get like a firsthand look at just how horrible the struggle is for someone who is an addict. And we were talking about some of the behaviors that come along, like the odd behaviors that go along with having an addiction that you wouldn't think of, which are essentially lying and stealing and things like that, things that, kind of society deems as immoral. But this also goes into mental illness as well, where people can have kind of strange behaviors that, society doesn't understand or deems immoral. And today I just wanted to talk about those, get them out there in the open so people know that this isn't about the person. And some of these behaviors they're hard to rein in and they're hard to manage. And as I titled this, this episode, Hate the Addiction, Not the Addict, I wanted to just make it clear that a lot of these behaviors have nothing to do with that person and what they want. So Margaret is on the line now. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, Chrissy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good.
Good. I'm sure you just heard a little bit of my intro just about why I thought that this topic is important. So I'm going to let you talk a little bit about what it is we're going to talk about today and kind of your personal experience with it, because you are the expert on this topic for sure.
Well, I wouldn't say expert. I've lived the journey with my son who struggled with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and addiction. Which one came first, that's always but that self-medicating, and where addiction takes over your life. And when you talk with all those behaviors, so important for people to know that that's the disease and not the person. And I think that's really important, whether you're a family member struggling with or trying to help someone or in the midst of it, or if it's somebody that's struggling with addiction themselves. I think it's real important for people to know that.
Talk about some of those talk about some of the behaviors and some of those things. You know, I mentioned a couple of them, and I know that it's pretty typical for someone who's an addict to lie, sometimes steal, hide things from people. Talk about some of those behaviors, and if you've had any personal experience that happened, and how it made you feel. I mean, like the raw part of how it made you feel.
Well, yes, it's as a parent, it's incredibly almost traumatizing because you raise your child to, you know, you talk about those moral, you'd raise them to know right from wrong and obviously not to steal and lie and all the things that you do as a parent for years and years and years. But with addiction, because the addiction takes over someone's mind, and it's that never-ending want for the drug or alcohol or whatever their choice is, they will do things that is so out of character for that person. And they don't like it. It just exacerbates the shame and the guilt and the struggle that they are having with this disease. So on a personal basis, I mean, that's happened with the, you know, whether it be stealing money, you know, stealing whatever to sell to get money. All those things happen, and that was so out of character for my son. And I remember saying, that's not the child I raised, and that's not the person I know. But it was so out of character. But that's what happens,
Margaret,
with addiction.
Let me ask you something. You said they don't want to do it, but they do it, but they have to do it. Explain that.
Well, I think I'm a mom and live the journey. I'm not the doctor, but I believe, and I believe this because what my son told me is there is a craving that becomes so strong that the brain is, you know, I don't know the technical terms, but the brain literally needs that, and the body craves it, and so they fight to get that, to get whatever they need. But no one wants to be an addict. I mean, if someone says, oh yeah, I love to be an addict, well, that's a big hole, either excuse or I can't figure out how to get through this, so I'm going to say that. But nobody wants that. And nobody wants to be stealing and lying, and it's horrendous, and it's horrendous for them. And I don't think people understand that, you know, people go, oh, you know, well, they just, you know, they stole. No one wants to do that. But it's a disease.
Okay, so if that's what they want, okay, so, and I'm just kind of furthering the conversation, trying to think how people can understand this. You know, it's because if they just have that craving and need to satisfy it, why don't they just ask instead of steal and lie? Why don't they?
Well, because there's such a stigma to addiction that they already feel bad that they are struggling with addiction. So if you were struggling with that, would you go ask, hey, I need to borrow some money because
nope.
I'm... You know, no,
yeah.
No.
Because I always want people to know.
Yeah, they hide it. They hide it. They lie. They hide. They everything. That's really important to know. And as you associate also with mental health, and I know especially with OCD, because OCD, people who struggle with OCD know that it's not right. Know that what they're doing doesn't feel good and doesn't, you know, in their mind, they know that. And it's, so that's even more, oh my gosh, I'm crazy because I'm doing this and I know that it's, I don't want to be doing it. And so that just is torturous. It'd be different if, you know, you thought that was what you were supposed to be doing. But when you know, then it's painful. And addiction mm-hmm. is painful.
Do you think that addicts are aware that they are hurting and disappointing their family members and their support system?
Yes. Yes, I do. I mean, I think sometimes they are it's so consuming that in the moment they don't think about it. But yes,
right.
They do eventually. Maybe not in the moment or when they're high. But yes, when they're not, yes, they do. And then
they
feel worse.
And so that further exacerbates the shame and mm-hmm. the guilt and the nobody is going to be able to love and accept me because I am an addict.
Right. Exactly.
Talk about the product of denial when it comes to addiction, and what that, how you've seen that in your experience as a support for someone who has an addiction.
Oh, I think that is one of the first things that happens. Denial is what most addicts go through at the very beginning because they don't want to admit it, and that becomes part of almost the lies. You know, it all ties in together. But denial is huge.
So you don't think it's just denial to the people around them, it's denial to themselves?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, probably yeah. Starts denial to the people around them. Or, well, I say that. It's probably denial within, and then they're trying to justify it to everybody else.
Right. So, okay, let's talk about your experience a little bit. And when those things happen and you're sitting there going, this is, and I know Riley personally, and so, I understand how out of character those things are. Riley was so concerned about hurting anybody. Mm-hmm. But I also understand the component of addiction where, not really screw everybody else, but it's kind of like, I have to get this and I have to satisfy this addiction right now. So how did you manage kind of like what the title of this podcast is? How did you manage to look at it just as an addiction versus this is my son and having anger and frustration toward him? And I'm sure you did have anger and frustration, but can you talk a little bit about how you saw that, or was there a switch that you finally just, realized that it was the addiction part and not Riley?
The more I educated myself about addiction, I went through all those emotions, anger, shame, embarrassment. I was embarrassed, or I was that's what was happening. But once I educated myself about addiction and what it was really about, that helped me.
You have to go the other way.
Not that it was. I can say to this day, do I completely understand it? Do I? I look back now, and maybe I would have done some different, but I can't do that. mm-hmm. So when you're going through it, oh my gosh, it's painful to watch the person. It's painful for the family members. And it will, and in the moment you don't always know what to do, but mm-hmm. So I can look back now and reflect. I think very important if someone as a family member is struggling with somebody with addiction, educate yourself and know about what an addict is like, what they do, how to recover. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you have to go through that whole gamut.
Okay. I see that we have another caller. Is there? Do we have someone on hold that I know?
I think so.
Okay. Should I bring that person on?
I think she's going to listen for a while, and she might have some feedback at some point.
Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and make that an option, and if she wants
okay.
to jump in, she can introduce herself and talk.
Okay.
There's one thing I want to ask, you know, just to clarify, because I know that this is the thing I think that stumps most people when it comes to addicts, and they're not able to see through that. It's the, okay, well, you know what? I have two questions, but I want to ask this one first. You know, you're hurting your family because you're lying. You're hurting your family because you're doing all this stuff. You're so selfish. Why can't you just not take that drink? Why can't you just not do that? Tell me, Margaret, tell me and the listeners, why is it they can't just stop doing it?
Well, as we've done in other shows, addiction is a disease. It's not always a choice. And what Riley had said, once you've had one, then 1,000 isn't enough. So it changes the chemicals in your brain, and that's why addiction is so hard. There's some new studies, I've been listening to different parts of programs that are saying, well, you know, with addiction, and Chrissy, I don't know if you've heard this, where, you know, they put the rats in a cage, and one of the water was laced with drugs, and one was plain, and if they were by
mm-hmm.
themselves, the rat immediately drank, you know, the drug-tainted water and would kill itself. And then they did an environment where it was like, you know, rat heaven and everything was great and it was with other rats and everything. And the difference in what they did. So, you know, that's what Riley had written about, you know, the social part of addiction and the mentoring each other. Because putting an addict in prison is not going to help. it's a disease, and how do we help them? And and I say all that because I've been trying to discover what would be powerful source for someone who struggles and wants recovery. What would help them? And, I mean, I think that's what, you know, the country needs to look at, because our drug problem is horrendous.
Do you believe that most addicts want recovery or think that's possible?
I think most addicts want recovery. I mean, wouldn't you want a better life? But many addicts think that that's not a possibility, can't get there, won't ever be able to get there, don't have, you know, what it takes, whether that be financially, et cetera, or just mentally can't get there. But I think human nature would be that they want to get better.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we do a very good job at helping that.
Now, I think that there is such a high rate of dual diagnosis and working in the mental health field as a peer, I see it all the time, which is the typically, if I can dig a little bit deeper, I find out that the addiction happened And for my listeners, dual diagnosis means that you have a mental health diagnosis and you have addiction together. I typically find out that people have the disorder first, and that the addiction came to mask the symptoms of the disorder.
Yeah,
so they were
experiencing
horrible symptoms, and whether it be the shame or the embarrassment or just the confusion about what is going on with my brain, they found that self-medicating was the only way to be able to turn things off for a while. And as someone who has OCD, I absolutely know that to be true. First time I took a drink when I was 21 years old, right after I was diagnosed, I was like, whoa, anxiety just went away. Hello, let me have another.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so then here comes the question, the million-dollar question, what do we treat first? Do we treat addiction first, or do we treat the mental illness first?
I don't think you can. I think you have to do them simultaneously. I think that's the key to is with a dual diagnosis. You can't treat one, because you treat one, it gets better. The other one gets worse. So then you go to the next. You go to the other one. I mean, that was Riley. It was just always back and forth. So I think programs have to be equipped to treat dual diagnosis.
So, and people ask this all the time who don't have addiction or a mental health issue. You know, why if the disorder came first, why not treat the disorder first? And so the way that I explain it is this: if someone has a dual diagnosis of OCD and addiction, let's look at the scenario. You treat OCD first and you risk an overdose. You treat addiction first and they're getting pounded by OCD and they don't have any relief. So
eventually they're going to search for something. That's human nature. You'll search for something for relief.
Mm-hmm. And anyone who has not experienced a mental illness, it's hard for them to understand, like, when you're 100% symptomatic, life is miserable. It is miserable. You can't function. I know it's really trivial, but I try to liken it to, what would you do if you had severe heartburn all day, every day? Like, you would eventually, you just can't function. You're in pain all the time. You can't do the things that you want to do. And people are always like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But it's that's exactly what it's like.
Right, right. And that's on that small scale. Think if your brain is torturing you 24/7, it's, horrendous.
So here's a question that we can toss around a little bit. People tend to say addicts have to lose everything to finally ask for help. And I do think that this is what happens a lot of times, is that, the family just can't take it anymore. Their close friends can't take it anymore, especially because of some of these, behaviors that people don't understand are symptoms of addiction, like that look immoral and that look like, I don't want to hang around with a person that does these things or whatever. I've heard this. I don't know if it's true, but what do you think that, an addict finally has to lose everything? They have to hit absolute rock bottom to really be serious about treatment, because they can't be trusted. You can't trust an addict. I always love that. I mean, I don't love it, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean.
What are your thoughts on that?
You know what? I hear that all the time, and you always say, gosh, you thought that would be rock bottom. I don't necessarily feel like that's true. I think something in their life changes, and whether that's when they're at rock bottom or before. And unfortunately, that's, so I think that's where, as a community and society if we help that, so they don't have to hit rock bottom in order to get help. It happens before that. But that happens a lot, that people, you know, it's a continuous cycle. And not all, even the ones that hit rock bottom, don't get better.
Right. Well, so what are some of the things that we can do? I kind of feel at a loss sometimes when on how to talk to people. How do you talk to someone when you know that they need help? Because it is a slippery slope, I think. It's a, first of all, you don't want to approach it like, by the way, I see that you're an addict and I see all these horrible behaviors, because then the addict knows, oh my God, I've disappointed this person. Oh my God, I feel so embarrassed. I feel so ashamed. And typically you're going to get a defensive response. I mean, that's just human nature to be, I don't want anything to do with you because you're calling me out and this is something I can't help. So how can we talk to people, approach them in a way that doesn't exacerbate the shame, but allows them to know, I'm here to help. I really want to help you. What can I do? What's some good advice? And I want you to go first, and then I'll kind of throw out what I would do, but I'd rather hear what you have to say first.
Well, Chrissy, I would say kind of some of the words you use, just how you approach that. I think that's super important. When you approach somebody, either I understand or I'm here to help, it takes away sort of that shame and that guilt. And I think that's so important for people to understand, that with an addict, they're really looking for some guidance, and I always say they want to get better. So I think that's, as if we approach it in a different way, you know, there's such a stigma that it's always a negative and towards an addict. So if it became more, how can I help you? What can we do? And then your actions, then get them to someone, or get them to, you know, an AA meeting, or introduce them to other people that are struggling. Because I think when you have that support, that peer support, that's going to be part of the recovery process, is having, and that's why I say with like these residential programs, you know, it's all great. Everybody gets in there and then, you know, they're sober and they're clean and then, you know, they're released and here's a piece of paper, do this, this, and this. Well, but what if we had programs within those residential or whatever program, whether it be AA or mental health, that they already had a core support group. So when they leave, they have that core support group that continues as they go into the real life. But we don't make that very available for people.
And I think I would add, and I'm gonna tell you that I thought this way too until this stigma for myself was broken down. When I didn't know what addiction was, or I didn't know what addicts, kind of like what kind of people were addicts, I had this image in my head of what addicts look like, and I deemed them as bad. Those bad people are addicts. And then when I found out, basically, they're all around me, that addiction just doesn't know any sort of boundary socially or, you know, racially or age-wise or anything, that I think that's what broke it down for me, was addicts are not bad people. And typically, I guess my advice, not really advice, but just if I was put in the situation where I knew someone was an addict, I knew that, I didn't even know if they needed help, but I knew from an outside perspective that they needed help, I think I would educate myself on what addiction is and I think this goes hands down for any mental illness, educate yourself on what it is and what it isn't. And I would approach that person with the facts, meaning,
yep,
I bet this is what you're experiencing. I bet you're feeling this way, and that this is the shame that goes along. I bet you feel embarrassed. I bet you feel guilty, and I bet you feel shamed. And I cannot imagine what that must feel like every single day. I mean, the biggest thing about being a peer support, even if you don't, and this is what we've talked about with George before, is that
mm-hmm.
you don't have to have an actual disorder, or you don't have to be an addict to be able to help somebody. It's stepping into their shoes for a second. If you know what the symptoms are to any illness, and like actually think to yourself, good Lord, if I had schizophrenia, here's what I would be dealing with. You can walk up to a schizophrenic and say, I cannot imagine how hard your life must be. And right there, that drops all the shame. It drops all the guilt. It's holy crap, someone finally understands. Even if you don't, you could imagine. I mean, I cannot imagine being so trapped by addiction that I would do things to hurt other people, and you know, in the way of like lying and stuff like that. I can't imagine how horrible that would be on a daily basis, knowing you're hurting people, but you can't stop it because of that damn addiction. Like, how mm-hmm. miserable would that be?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's it, I think. So educate, raise awareness, educate yourself, and have empathy, empathy and understanding, I think, is your way to approach someone. And then educate yourself on resources, et cetera. So you mm-hmm. have a whole, you know, you're ready to say, okay, you know, this is what's happening. Let's see how we can help you.
Right. And relapse is pretty prevalent with addiction and any mental illness in general. Let's talk a little bit about what that must feel like. What is relapse? Okay, so someone, you know, finally admits, and then they go get help, you know, whatever, and God, this spans across mental illness too. And then they relapse. What is that? What do you think that feels like for the addict, and what does that feel like for the support?
Well, you're in denial if you think that's not going to happen, because more than likely
exactly.
it is. So that's where you educate yourself and know that that happens. And then when it happens, what do you do? And for the addict, if you can get them somewhere that there's not the stigma that, you know, I thought you were okay.
Mm-hmm.
But whoever, you know, you get them the help. And I think that's like with AA, people go back and people are like, it's okay, we've all done it. Now, where do
yep.
you start from here?
Yep.
Let's start and just move forward. And being a part of a social support group that understands that, and there's no stigma, there's no, that happens. Now, what do we do? Let's go forward.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens if there's the stigma and the shame and the guilt, because there is, they have that, that's more personal, but if they can go and not have that, they're more likely to go back and get help and immediately and start back.
Right. Right. And if they know that they have the support of their support
absolutely.
System, that's like, and I think that should be something that is really, that's communicated to people that are, you know, headed toward recovery, toward the support system and the person. By the way, you're going to relapse. And nobody wants to think that they are. I mean, we all want to think, oh, whatever, we're going to be, you know, I'm going to get treatment for my mental illness and I'm never going to deal with it again. Yeah, right. I mean,
yeah.
anybody that thinks that is out of their mind. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that should be part of it is, okay, you're going to relapse. So, you know, they have the Wellness Recovery Action Plan. It's called WRAP. Have you ever heard of this, Margaret?
Mm-mm.
The WRAP
What's it
program.
Called?
So the Wellness Recovery Action Plan, it's WRAP. It's this great program where you go through a class and create a program for relapse. And it's when I first took it, you know, of course, I live in denial half the time. But when I first took the course, I was like, I don't need this. Like, whatever. You know, if I have relapse, mm-hmm. I got it under control. It's not a big deal. But what it does is it step by step tells you write out a plan that says, if this starts to happen, here are the signs that it's happening to you. This is what it feels like. Here's who you call, like step by step, even like who could be responsible for paying your bills if you have to go to the hospital, X, Y, and Z. And I remember going through this, and I was like, yeah, this is all helpful information. And by the way, Margaret, you are part of my action plan. So
okay.
I didn't ask permission, but, you know. But anyway, I did this, and then I did this, and then 2 months later, I was in a relapse. And I remember thinking, I need to pull out that action plan. Because once right. it hit me that I was in the relapse, I was like, okay, let me look at it. I didn't have to think. I just looked at, this is what you need to do. This is who you need to call. This is what's going to happen afterward. And this is how you pick yourself up and not feel like you're a piece of crap because you relapsed. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that could be so helpful for addicts too. Just to know, this is going to happen. You're going to relapse. And when you do, you don't have to feel like you're the biggest loser on the planet.
Right. For the addict and also for the family member, because to educate and have a plan. Because,
right.
You know, I didn't. And you know, what I've learned in the meantime. But I didn't. So it became crisis. And if
right.
there was more of a plan, yeah, I agree.
I've said this before. I can't remember who I've said it with or if it was on air. But it's worth mentioning again, and I'm going to mention something that you've mentioned in a previous show, which is so important. It should be a mantra. when you have a mental illness or an addiction, like, I could make $1 billion overnight, and I would still think that the people who know me with the mental illness, especially family, would think, well, she could have probably made $2 billion if she didn't have that mental illness. Like, there is something about having a mental illness and addiction or addiction where you just feel like such a loser. I mean, you can't win. You know, there's like all the pride's gone. Like, nobody will ever think of you as good and I just feel like, or I just wish that wasn't, and I don't even think that's probably true. It might be, I don't know, maybe my family does think that. But it is that personal stigma of, now I am a horrible person. No one's ever going to look at me the same. Like, to me, I just think, I've done this advocacy for a couple years. I could stop right now. And 40 years from now, when I'm like 80, I would probably worry that people would see me and then be like, yeah, that's that girl that was mentally ill. It's just that brand on you. And I guess I wanted to make that point just to emphasize what you said a few episodes ago that we did together, which is people don't want to be an addict. They don't want to have a mental illness. We hate it. We'd do anything in the world to get rid of it. We'd do anything. The addicts would do anything to be able to say,
right.
Nah, I don't want that drink tonight. Nah, I don't really want to do coke tonight. That's what people need to understand. Nobody is excited about having a mental illness or addiction.
And really important, Chrissy, is that people see their mental illness or their addiction is not who they are. That's their disease, but that's not who they are. That wonderful person like you or Riley, all the great things you can do. So it's, there's, but like you say, there's always that stigma and, you know, for me, but I'm probably, because I've lived it with Riley, I don't see it that way. But you're right, probably, maybe other people do, or the person dealing with it does.
Yes.
But the more we can make addiction or mental health that where you have people that support you and love you for who you are, because you know what? Everybody has some stuff, you know? And,
yep.
And sometimes that's a gift and a strong point. And, you know, there's, I mean, I think once you've gone through things, it makes you stronger and it, it gives you empathy for others. And
yes.
To me, those are important qualities. So if we could make it.
I think that could be added to, if you are talking to someone who's an addict and you want to help, you know, and you don't know what to say, that could be a great thing to add. I know this isn't who you want to be, but you can't help it. You
right.
can't stop something because it's bigger than who you are, but it's not
yeah.
who
so,
you are.
So have them talk about, so tell me, let's not talk about your addiction or your mental health. Tell me about you. What are some of your...
Mm-hmm.
Your passions, your loves, what are you good at? What do you like to do? You know what? Then it becomes not about that. People need to
yeah.
see, you know, because that's, I mean, everybody needs to see that.
Because people who are addicts and people who have mental illness, just like I said before, they think they're branded. Like there's that scarlet freaking letter on their chest of, now that people know I'm an addict, they will always see me as that junky addict, because, you know, some, you know, that horrible image of what you think an addict looks like. And
mm-hmm.
that is just simply not the case.
Right.
At all.
Right.
So we have about 2.5 minutes left. And we always get to this point, too, where, like, the show is going to end and we all of a sudden have 10,000 things to say.
I know, and then we're cut off.
So let's leave. So now we have 2 minutes and 10 seconds. So what are your final thoughts, Margaret, and then we'll wrap up?
You know, I go back to our discussion with George, who had such good ideas for addiction and recovery, and I think a huge part of, as a society, we need to look at addiction, and it's take, you know, if we can, the stigma, and how can we help people in recovery. And I think it's the key points. Those key points is the social part, the peer support, and people understanding that that's the disease and not the person. That would be my say.
And I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, my final thoughts on this are that no matter what you think addiction is, whatever you think addiction and mental illness is in your own mind, I would challenge you to reach out to people who are advocates and talk to them and listen to their story. And that is what's
yeah.
going to break your image of it, and that's what's going to help you to understand the reality of it and to be able to be an empathizer and somebody that can help. So, yeah, we have less than a minute now, but I think this is a great show and a topic definitely worth exploring, and I'm sure we can explore more next time. But, Margaret, love you. Thank you for everything that you do, and you are just such a good advocate.
Thank you, Chrissy. You too. Thank you for having the show. Love you.
You're welcome. And to my listeners, thank you for joining us today. I hope you took away something from this topic. It is so important, and we're just going to continue to talk about this openly. If you have any questions for me or Margaret, you can reach me at OCD mentalillnessmatters@chrissie.com. Visit me at Facebook on Mental Illness Matters. You've been listening today, where we're breaking down the stigma one personal story at a time.